This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 144 was recorded on December 6th, 2018. I'm Eric Townsend. JDI Research founder Juliette DeClercq has been one of our most popular feature interview guests and is known for her fantastic graphs and charts. Juliette is back as this week's feature interview guest, and once again, there's a great chart deck to download linked in your Research Roundup email. We'll discuss everything from the market's perception of a dovish pivot in Fed policy to the U.S. dollar outlook to what Juliette plans to present at the Macro Voices live event in Vancouver on January 19th. Be sure to stay tuned for extended equity market coverage in our post-game segment after the feature interview, when Patrick and I will return to the equity market chart book and consider the big moves we've seen in equity markets in reaction to the roller coaster of Chinese trade war news that's come out in the last week.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, the S&P 500, what a pop and drop that we saw there off the G20. What's your take on the S&P here?
Well, it seems pretty clear that we've established the consolidation range between about 2620 and 2820. It's unusual when you see a major consolidation range on a major index like the S&P that you hit both ends of that range, not in the same day, but within a couple of days. And I've got to hand it to you, Patrick, because you totally nailed this move in your Sunday market note, which you published before the market reopened on Sunday evening after the G20 meeting. And that you wrote, and I'm quoting here, "We are going to come into this week actively looking to short sell any strength after the G20 meetings. I am suspicious that the strength will be faded. Any S&P shorts will need to be done in hedged position trades, as we will likely need to hold into January to see a real turn play out." Well, you totally nailed the turn, although I think that your short trade played out a little earlier than January. What a roller coaster it's been. And to be sure, Patrick, this has been all about just completely changing news narrative. First, you've got the G20, and hey, you've got at least an appearance of a handshake, and really, it wasn't an agreement that everything was better. It was only a stay of execution. Trump and Xi agreed that they would continue disagreeing for the next 90 days or so without actually imposing sanctions. And of course, that resulted in the big pop much higher. There was a huge gap up open on S&P 500 futures when the market opened Sunday evening. And sure enough, exactly as you predicted, although I don't know that you could have predicted the news, Mr. Trump was out in the news first thing on Monday morning, and somehow his charming effects caused a little bit of reaction to the downside in the market. And before we knew it, we'd come off of that 2,800 plus high end of the trading range. And just this afternoon, we tested the bottom end of that range, which is around 2,620. I think the low print was actually 2,621. So we're within a point or so. So we know where the range is. We did see a very, very pronounced bounce off of that. And I think that the world is really waiting for some consistent messaging out of Washington and Beijing. Are these guys at it with trade wars in full swing or not? And of course, the big move to the downside on Tuesday was a result of news that the Huawei CFO had been arrested in Canada at the request of the United States. Needless to say, the friendly cooperation between China and the U.S. came into question in the market's eyes at that point. So I think until the news gets clearer, we're going to see more volatility. What I would watch for in terms of a clear signal would be for a breakout outside of that wide 200-point trading range between 2620 and 2820, and I think headlines are going to dictate which direction that goes to. You've done some really fantastic work, Patrick. I want to give you credit. Let's come back and get into your full big-picture trading market chart book in the post-game segment after the feature interview with Juliette DeClercq, where we can get into the charts and really get into some detail on what's happening in this market.
All right. Well, let's move on to the U.S. dollar index, because what I find actually the most fascinating thing is that for all the volatility in equities and bonds, the dollar seems pretty pinned. Now, obviously, the euro is the largest input variable in the Dixie. But what's interesting here is that really no big moves. I mean, we've been more or less pinned to the 96.50 to 97.50 range for a better part of a month. Is this range going to break?
Well, I hope it breaks to the upside. That certainly has been my expectation. I'm still not worried about that. You know, of course, it seems like every time I turn around, somebody else is predicting the imminent crash of the dollar. But it hasn't been happening. And I think that the dollar liquidity shortage is still in play. Now, definitely pay close attention to Julia DeClercq, because she sees the same dollar liquidity shortage that I see and Jeff Snyder sees. But she comes to different conclusions about what it means for the dollar index. So there's definitely room for different views here. I still have a dollar bullish view as a result of that. What would change my mind, though, is if we really and truly saw the dovish pivot confirmed. In other words, I think the market overreacted to Jay Powell's comments. I don't think the Fed has really signaled a dovish pivot. They're done hiking and they're going to pause their hiking cycle. I don't think we're quite there yet. If it turns out that I'm wrong and, you know, let's say Keith McCullough is proven right and the December rate hike is the last rate hike, well, that probably is going to spell a different outlook for the dollar. But unless that happens, Patrick, I think we move higher.
All right, well, let's move on to oil, because I've been waiting to hear what your insights were on this all week. Obviously, we have an OPEC meeting right here, and crude oil has like literally not budged off this lower $50 range. What's happening here?
Well, what's happening is everybody, and I mean everybody, was just sure that there was going to be a very significant cut out of this OPEC meeting, and they thought this morning on Thursday that that would be announced. Now, as soon as I saw the huge gap up open on Sunday, I tweeted immediately saying, I think this is a bull trap, guys. Be careful here, because even though everybody is absolutely certain that the cut is a certainty, I haven't seen Saudi Arabia say decisively that they're going to cut. They've agreed that a cut is needed. That's not the same as saying that we're going to cut. You've got to listen to these guys literally in their semantics of what they say. Now, Patrick, crude oil inventory was delayed a week due to the day of mourning that was scheduled on Wednesday, so we didn't get our crude oil inventory until Thursday. When it finally came out, that's approximately the same time as the OPEC meeting was wrapping up, we had a massive 7.3 million barrel drawdown. That's against analyst expectations of a 2 million barrel drawdown. So you would think really big, unexpected drawdown in crude oil inventories ought to be super bullish for prices. You know what? We barely even moved, and we retraced what we did move pretty quickly. There was a build in Cushing, Oklahoma, 1.7 million barrels. Finished products building, and I think that offset the crude oil drawdown to some extent. 1.7 million barrel build on gasoline, 3.8, very big build on distillates. But still, I think the real story here is about OPEC. Everybody was so sure that this meeting would produce a cut. Now, I think it is still going to produce a cut, but I think that what delayed it and the reason they were unable to reach an agreement on Thursday and had to announce a postponement of any announcement until Friday is that they had some pretty heated arguments about what size of a cut. So I think there's a very real possibility, although it's difficult for me to imagine no cut whatsoever. What I think is on Mohammed bin Salman's mind is he needs to stabilize market prices so they don't crash from here. And if there was no cut at all, I think a crash is absolutely possible. When's the last time everybody expected for certain that OPEC was going to cut and they didn't? Well, that would be Thanksgiving of 2014, and look at what happened after that. Mohammed bin Salman does not want to allow that to happen, but I think he just as strongly does not want a major rebound in price. He does not want to upset President Trump, because President Trump is holding all of the cards now politically. President Trump could easily make a big deal. There's more and more evidence that's coming out that looks like Mohammed bin Salman personally ordered the murder and execution of Jamal Khashoggi. If President Trump wanted to, he could make a big issue out of this and push Saudi Arabia to sack MBS in order to save face on the global stage. Trump knows that he has all the power, and I think MBS is afraid to do anything to upset Trump. So I'm speculating here, Patrick, but I believe that what's going on is the market is expecting that there's going to be a great big cut, maybe 1.5 million or more barrels per day, and that's going to result in a great big rebound bounce here. We're going to go back up, and the lows are already in at $49 or whatever the low print was. I think there's a very real possibility that we get a cut, but a much smaller cut than anybody expected. And there's maybe a little bounce, but we end up eventually selling off to even lower prices. Now, I'm speculating based on the fact primarily that I haven't seen Saudi Arabia willing to make any decisive statements. When all the other OPEC countries were saying, we're committed, we're ready to a cut, there's a consensus for a cut, we're going to have a cut. Everybody's with very definitive messaging, and Saudi Arabia is very vague, unclear messaging. It says to me they're afraid to take a stand for some reason, and I don't think it's changed yet. So we'll have to see what tomorrow brings, and by the time most of you listen to this episode, that news will probably be out. My guess is it's a small cut. Now, certainly, if we get 1.2 million barrel cut or bigger, it's likely to result in a significant rebound, at least initially, in the market. If we get a smaller cut than that, I wouldn't be surprised if we eventually drift down to even lower prices. One thing to consider here is exports were an all-time record, 3.2 million barrels a day. So just imagine, Patrick, that's 22.4 million barrels of oil that was exported last week. That means that that 7.3 million barrel drawdown would have been a 15 million barrel build on inventory, super duper bearish inventory build, if not for the massive export number. Okay, why is that number so high, and where did the oil go? I think the answer is China ordered something like 3 VLCC cargoes of oil. And if that was exported last week and made up much of that number, okay, if that trend continues, in other words, if the trade tensions all resolve themselves and China keeps buying U.S. oil, we're going to continue drawing down U.S. inventory, and that could be bullish for prices. But if what we see is a breakdown in relations between China and the United States, and certainly with this arrest that has occurred in the last 48 hours, that's a very real possibility. You could see those exports drop off a cliff, and all of a sudden we could be back to a big pattern of U.S. inventory builds, and that could take us much lower in price. So I think it really remains to be seen what happens in the news flow as far as what happens next with oil. The next really big thing is going to be the OPEC meeting, but keep watching inventory in coming weeks, and keep watching whether or not Chinese relations with the United States improve to the point where they can continue to export U.S. oil to China.
Eric, I want to move on to gold. And what we continue to see is gold behaving like a very defensive asset as the market is going risk off. Gold seems to be catching the bid. What's going on here?
Yeah, you know, what was it, months on this program, Patrick? Every time we do gold on the market wrap, it's like, okay, guys, nothing new to say. It's the opposite of the dollar index. There's no news here. That's it. Okay, it's different now. We have had several days where we've seen gold and the dollar moving up at the same time, which is very inconsistent with the usual inverse relationship. In the last couple of days, we've seen moves up in gold when there was a move down in the dollar index, but it was a very, very small move down in the dollar and a significant move up in gold. So what we keep seeing as a pattern here is a lot of the time the dollar and gold are trading in their usual seesaw pattern of inverse relationship, but the exceptions always seem to be to the upside in gold. So it seems like gold is kind of looking for an excuse to break out here. Could that be related to the fact that the two biggest economies in the world are dueling in a way that involves, you know, handshakes at meetings and everything is fine, and a couple of days later they're arresting the CFO of a major company that's involved in this trade negotiation? I think probably. So I think what we're seeing more and more, Patrick, is gold operating and trading in its traditional role, as a hedge against geopolitical risk and as a safe haven asset. So I think that maybe we're seeing the beginnings of something, but as I look at the numbers, one thing I want to clarify, because a whole bunch of our listeners have been tweeting it, we have talked a lot on this program about Charlie McElligott's CTA model, which predicts where algorithmic traders are going to change their positioning. And when he was on the program, he told us 1245 was the magic number to watch in gold. That was true on the day that we had Charlie on the program, but those models are dynamic. They move with the markets. As of this morning's daily note from Charlie McElligott, that same inflection point on gold is now at 1284. So Charlie's model now shows CTA's 3% net long gold. They would move to 89% net long gold on a daily close over 1284. So that number that we're looking for a daily close over to really signal a CTA algorithmic buying event has moved quite a bit higher than it was. But I think still, if we just look independent of that figure at the chart generally, we haven't seen a breakout yet, but it feels to me like gold's looking for an excuse to make one, and I'll be watching it very carefully.
All right, I want to move on to the 10-year Treasury yields, because we were talking about for a month about, you know, 325 rejecting, and that we've been range-bound between 305 to 325. But boy, we came in, like, no sooner did we finish the episode last week did the yields just break down to 3 and then just rip right through. I think we lost almost 25 basis points on the downside in a week. At the low print, I think we were down to around the 2.82 yield. What's going on here? Is this a game changer for bonds?
Well, Patrick, first of all, I got to really hand it to Keith McCullough from HedgeEye. When he was on this program on the 15th of November, he sounded like a lunatic, frankly, when he said, look, 3.25, that was it. I want to see confirmation on a move below 305. As soon as we get that confirmation, I think it's a quick ride down in yield, and we're headed toward 250, 260 in there somewhere. And I thought, okay, this guy is a nutcase. Well, guess what? It's played out exactly the way he said. You know, Patrick, a rule that I like to use is I don't think any of these guys are always right or always wrong. People get in the groove with the market, and they get on a roll sometimes. And one of my rules is that when somebody's on a roll and he's getting some calls that nobody else is getting and nailing it, I look at, okay, what is that same guy saying about other markets at the same time as he's getting other things right? And one of the things Keith said in that interview was that he expected the Fed to hike rates for the last time in December, and that there would be no more hikes in December 19. When we looked at what the market was discounting through the Eurodollar futures market, that seemed just totally crazy. But now, not only has Keith been proven right on yields, but the Eurodollar futures market, and we should come back to this in the postgame segment, is now discounting exactly what Keith said. So Keith's been nailing it with these fixed income calls. I want to give credit there, and I just look at, okay, he's the guy who said, as crazy as it sounded, we're headed back towards 250, 260. Let's give that some possibility. I think 280 and then 260 would be major support levels before we went lower than that. And it really brings to my mind, if he's right, and that means that the December rate cut is the last rate cut, that answers the question of the dovish pivot. Keith thinks that it really is a dovish pivot. I have been discounting that. I thought people were overreacting to Jay Powell's comments, and it wasn't really upon us yet. So it remains to be seen, but frankly, I had a view that was at odds with Keith. So far, Keith's getting the calls right, so I've got to just give credit where it's due. I find it hard to believe that we're done with this hiking cycle already, but certainly things are playing out that way. And I want to come back to that Eurodollar futures chart in postgame, because that really makes a strong statement. The other thing that I wanted to mention is Juliet Brigden's chart left room for us to make room. If you looked at, you know, he's got to be one of the biggest bears on bonds that there is anywhere. But he said very clearly, hey, maybe we've seen this play out. And he's really talking about a glacial long-term picture when he talks about a secular bear market in bonds. bonds. He was very quick to say, in the case of a recession, which now it looks like we're seeing a lot of signals on, we should come back also in postgame to the yield curve inverting, at least at the front end of the curve in the U.S., that's a recession signal for sure. He's saying in a recession, we could get back to 2% easily on the 10-year before we eventually move to much higher numbers. So it seems like that lower bond yields moving into a recession, maybe the bear market is on a secular level, but we're ready to have a bull market in bonds on a cyclical basis into a recession cycle. And maybe that's already upon us. And I guess, you know, Keith told us that on November 15th. I didn't believe it at the time. I'm coming around to his point of view pretty darn quickly. In any case, the argument, I guess you could be long here, but if you took Keith's call from 325, he thinks we're getting to 250, 260. You know, we're already halfway there, so you've missed a lot of the move. I don't know that you want to jump into the long trade here, but it seems like that is what's playing out.
Well, thanks for the market update, Eric. Now, before we move on to the feature interview, we want to cover some housekeeping items. First, since Julian Brigden mentioned he plans on going skiing on Whistler after Macro Voices Live in Vancouver, we've been inundated with emails asking us about a Macro Voices ski social. So what's the plan, Eric?
Well, we don't really have a plan, but it's a great idea. So here's what we're going to do. Patrick and I cannot ski. We've got other travel plans. Most of our speakers are skiing. Some of our speakers, Julian Brigden, cough, cough, I think are coming mostly for the skiing. What we're going to do is this. Louis Gav has very generously offered for expert skiers only because he's a very aggressive skier who owns a home there and knows the mountain well to show people around. Meanwhile, Julia DeClercq and Gretchen Brigden very kindly offered to organize an après-ski get-together for Macro Voices listeners at Whistler sometime after Macro Voices Live. What we're going to do is just provide a place at the reception on Friday night for the skiers to all get together and make a plan, find a ski buddy, etc. So if you're going to Macro Voices Live and you're a skier, bring your boards with you. There will be other skiers there. We'll introduce you. We won't be organizing anything. We can't do that, but we'll certainly allow you guys to make your own plans.
We've also been getting emails from listeners who wanted to take advantage of HedgeEye's deep discount offer but couldn't find the links. What's going on there?
You know, Patrick, I don't know what's going on there because although we did screw up and not send that link out the first time, we sent a follow-up email with the link, and then it was in the following week's research roundup email, and I don't get why people still can't find it. But we're going to make it much easier. It's again in this week's research roundup email, and I'll read it on the air. Thankfully, there is a silver lining in this story. HedgeEye, because so many people couldn't find it, has agreed to extend their special offer, which was normally a Black Friday thing only, for one more week until December 13th. But they were very adamant in saying, that's it, you're cut off after December 13th. So the links for anyone who still can't find them, it's hedgeye.com/macrovoicesAAP for all access pass. That's the $895 deep discount off their $2,700 product. The other one is hedgeye.com/macrovoicesHIQ, Hotel India Quebec. That's the Hedge IQ product. I don't even remember what the price is, but it was another good discount. So you've got lots of places to find the links. We don't understand why nobody can find them, but there they are.
And finally, we had a few emails asking when we're going to be doing a feature interview about your new book, Beyond Blockchain. What's your thinking there?
We're not going to, Patrick. I really don't want to turn Macro Voices into an infomercial for my own book. So I am excited about the book. If you want to hear an interview all about it, Jesse Felder did an absolutely fantastic job. He asked better questions than we could have asked. We did do a post-game segment about it already, but if you want that, Jesse did a great job on his podcast. We're not going to turn Macro Voices into an infomercial. So there is a link in your research roundup email to Jesse Felder's Super Investors podcast. Talks all about the book. And he asked fantastic questions.
This week's featured interview guest is Juliette DeClercq, founder of JDI Research. Eric's interview with Juliette is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next is JDI Research founder Juliette DeClercq. Juliet has prepared another of her fantastic chart books for us. So be sure, listeners, to download it. You can find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you're not registered yet, just go to macrovoices.com, look for Juliet's picture on our homepage and the red button that says looking for the downloads next to her picture. Juliet, you have had a grim outlook on global activity since January of this year, and you've successfully translated that into substantial profits for your clients this summer. My question now, though, is the Trump-Xi agreement from the G20 a game change, as so many people seem to think it is?
Eric, that question is pretty much a whole GDI research report on its own, but I'll try and reply to it in a concise manner today and leave the reviewing of all leading indicators for the Vancouver conference in January. So the quick answer is that the trade war certainly aggravated the global slowdown, but it did not cause it. What really caused the global slowdown is a confluence of factors, which I'd like to review now. Firstly, a much tighter dollar liquidity. Now, it will not be a surprise for your listeners to hear that the global liquidity tide is intimately connected with US dollar liquidity. But I'd like to quickly go through this mechanism again, because it's one of the key to the 2019 outlook. So since World War II, the US dollar has been the primary global reserve currency. And in practice, it means that the dollar is at the crossroads of most real transactions, even when a transaction is priced in another currency and involves two countries other than the US. That's simply because the country's respective banks' main reserves are held in US dollars rather than whatever yen or sterling. The result is that when Japanese goods are exported to the UK and the payment is made in yen, the UK firm will effectively intermediate via euro dollar contracts, which is basically US dollar available outside the US. The upshot, and this is really key, is that the Fed, whether it openly acknowledges it or not, is the world's de facto central bank. So when engaged in quantitative easing, the Fed floods domestic banks with reserves and increases the domestic monetary base. This actually causes US demand to start growing faster than in the rest of the world, which causes the US current account to swell and basically floods the rest of the world with US dollar too. The result is that the Fed doesn't only increase the monetary base domestically, but it also increases the monetary base abroad, and generally the global monetary base increases. This year, as you know, the Fed engaged in quantitative tightening, and that's the first thing you will see on chart one. It means that global dollar liquidity stopped accelerating earlier this year and actually started to shrink this summer. So almost mathematically, global growth followed through. The hurdle for global dollar liquidity to reaccelerate today or next year is enormous, and it would probably take a global recession for G4 central banks to walk back a collective intent to get away from balance sheet normalization. So really, there should be very little relief coming on this side for 2019. The second culprit for the global slowdown is China. So the October 2017 National Communist Party Congress had the honorable ambition of shifting the country towards a longer-term, more sustainable growth model, less reliant on infrastructure investment and basically easy money. The result? Considerably more restrictive monetary and fiscal policy frameworks. And of course, you will see on chart two that it triggered a collapse in the credit impulse in 2018. Now, many believe this is old news. Faced with a raging trade war with the US, Chinese authorities have tried walking back the tightening in financial conditions by engaging in a series of monetary and fiscal stimuli to stop the downward trend in activity and shore up confidence. But this has been met with very little success so far. And as you will observe on chart three, the 6 months fiscal expenditure and total social financing impulse has continued to collapse. and there's literally been no organic growth in private credit. Investors today are still hoping for a return, even if temporary, to China's old economic model, which is basically a model necessitating large imports of commodities, material and industrial goods, and whose comeback would effectively be a boon for countries that are most leveraged to global trade, like emerging markets and, to a lesser extent, the EU. This could work in the short term because fiscal expenditure tends to be front-loaded to the start of the year in China. But in the longer run, though, we have a small problem, which is that wave after wave of stimuli have been used in China to boost fixed asset investment. And the inevitable consequence is that overcapacity issues and dramatically lowered expected returns on investment. And that's especially true with the state-owned corporate sector. And the next consequence of this is that looser credit standards are not really sufficient to support the economy. To spur economic growth at this point, it is the price of credit which needs to be addressed via lower yields rather than its liquidity. And this is something you will see on chart 4. In 2015, the drop in nominal GDP growth was accompanied by a commensurate 150 base point cut in the official lending rate, and that was on top of liquidity injections, which allowed corporate yields to drop in line with the much softer macroeconomic outlook. And it also allowed a sharp turnaround in credit flows. But on the same chart, you will see that in 2018, the problem is that only high-quality AAA corporate yields have dropped meaningfully by about 100 basis points. But for the rest of the credit sector, we still have exorbitant price of credit, and that means that companies are reluctant to deploy new capital.
Well, Juliet, I cannot wait to get both you and Jeff Snyder on stage at the same time to talk about euro dollars, but we'll have to save that for Vancouver. Meanwhile, though, what you're saying here is that the problem in China is that they need lower yields. So why don't they cut rates?
The problem the PBOC faces today is really an impossible trinity. This year, it's been instructed to discourage capital outflows and promote CNY's credibility as a store of value. The dilemma is that both mandates are mutually inconsistent. It's virtually impossible with the Fed hiking to lower official rates in China and keep the CNY stable at the same time. And that's something you can observe for yourself on chart 5. That's basically because Chinese capital flows are highly sensitive to the differential between the PBOC and the Fed's official rates. In addition, and this is something that U.S. Treasury Secretary Mnuchin reiterated today, the elusive China-U.S. trade deal would no question contain a clause preventing China from FX depreciation. The fact that the can was kicked 90 days down the road means that Chinese authorities are prevented from loosening monetary policy further, or they would basically face 25% tariff on all exports. I think this is perhaps the smartest outcome of the G20 meeting between Xi and Trump. Literally dragging the dispute out in time guarantees that China-induced deflationary pressures will stay at home, e.g. in China. Conversely, a breakdown in negotiations would have most certainly caused Chinese authorities to pull the trigger on lower rates and cause a sharp depreciation of the renminbi. So it is actually quite sensible for the U.S. to keep negotiations in limbo, but it doesn't mean that an armistice will follow the truce. For now, I think the bottom line, though, is that in China, the credit channel is clogged due to yuan stability constraints, and that the truce is unlikely to benefit the Chinese economy much, especially as uncertainty remains. Of course, you'll now ask me about the fiscal side as well, and I'd like to add something on that. I think Chinese authorities are still dead set on rebalancing the economy away from investment towards consumption. And that means that even a massive fiscal impulse, like comparable to what we had in 2009 or 2014-15, would be aimed at boosting consumption to benefit the domestic economy. And that would mean like it's a plus for China, but it doesn't contribute to the reflating the rest of the world. So in other words, trade war or no trade war, I think the global growth, global economy is stuck in low gear.
Okay, so big picture-wise, it sounds like your view is still that the global outlook continues to be challenging. Is that correct? And is there anything that would make you change your mind there?
Of course, many things can make me change my mind. I'm in no way dogmatic, and I'm constantly looking for reasons I may be wrong or become wrong. So, for example, the day before Powell's speech, a couple of GDR research sentiment indicators hit overly depressed levels. And I actually recommended taking profit in all risk-off trades ahead of key risk havens and warning that the 2019 consensus outlook had become a bit too grim. There is another lever on global growth than the quantity of dollar, and this lever is basically the price of dollar. So in 2018, adding insult to injury, the U.S. dollar strengthened. And that was obviously due to macro and monetary policy divergence. The issue there is that it amplifies the dollar liquidity squeeze. The strengthening dollar automatically deflates the level of existing global liquidity and causes FX reserves to shrink globally. And that basically undermines global economic prosperity. However, the reverse can also be true, meaning the existing global monetary base would revalue on a weaker dollar. So as a result, the dollar really still holds the key to the global outlook in 2019. And this is something that you can observe for yourself on chart 6.
Juliet, what an opportunity to ask you about the dollar, something I've been dying to do. As you mentioned, the potential of the U.S. dollar as the world savior, I want to ask you about your view on the Fed. A lot of people are now saying that Powell's speech in New York was a dovish pivot, and we've even had some people on this program predict that the December rate hike will be the last rate hike, and it's all over. Is there really a dovish pivot here, and what would undermine the U.S. dollar enough to brighten up your 2019 outlook?
Look, I think on that particular speech, markets were very long dollar. Consensus, as I just mentioned, turned really overly bearish the day before, even moving away from like 2020 consensus for a recession, 2019. So really markets were preconditioned to respond to any dovish tilts. So there is definitely an element of confirmation bias in last week's turnaround in risk and the dollar following Powell's speech at the New York Club. What I think is that the specific mention of rates being just below the neutral range and the supposed U-turn since October's we are a long way from neutral were overinterpreted. The broad range of FOMC estimates is at the moment 2.5 to 3.5%, and the target range for the Fed funds is now like 2 to 2.25. So I think Powell was really just stating a fact that the Fed is just one hike away from the bottom of that neutral range. Does this mean that there was no change in the Fed's reaction function? Absolutely not. But what it means is that what did not make the main headlines was where the dovish tilt actually was. And I think I was more interested to hear Powell talk about the economic effects of our gradual rate increases being uncertain, and the fact that they may take a year or more to be fully realized. My view on that is that such an emphasis on the long lag between monetary tightening and financial tightening will allow the Fed a clear path towards more data dependency. And indeed, I think it was really Vice Chairman Clarida's comments last week, which were much more revealing. And he noted that R star, though the neutral rates estimates, are highly uncertain, and that participants will be revising their estimates based on incoming data at each FOMC meeting. So I think really the bottom line is that the Fed's reaction function has changed, and it's moved from being on a perceived autopilot to be more readily responsive. In my opinion, this is a case of getting to the same level of interest rates with a more dovish tone, which I argued all year would be a more sensible strategy. And I think this could be sufficient to cap real yields and halt the broad dollar advances, but it will not be enough to support a much stronger global outlook via a deeply and broadly weaker dollar. And I think this is because the U.S. economy reconvergence with the rest of the world will not be so abrupt as to warrant an immediate Fed pause. So on that, I really disagree that the December hike is going to be the last one. In fact, I continue to expect hikes to be delivered at the pace of one per quarter, at least until 275 is reached. So that's three more hikes versus about two priced. And I would eventually look to fade the dollar weakness, especially versus China.
Okay, well, we're definitely in agreement that the market overinterpreted Powell's comments, but then you made some other comments that maybe were more open to the possibility of that dovish pivot. So do I understand correctly the dovish pivot is not a game changer yet?
So the one thing to bear in mind when analyzing monetary policy and its effect on financial assets is that it only hits aggregate demand with an average lag of up to like six quarters. In fact, our cycle analysis suggests that monetary accommodation leads aggregate demand by 2 years and that it starts being priced after about 18 months. And you can see that on chart 7. Such considerations actually allowed us to start taking a strict risk-averse approach this summer. And you will see on chart 7 that the past Fed tightening is only just flowing out of the pipeline. I think the issue there is that traders are trained to observe and anticipate the prompt and sometimes instant pricing in financial assets of events or data releases. And I think I would be speaking for all of us by saying that patience is one of our greatest challenges. But it's obviously a lot worse when it's up to like 18 months, when you have to be patient for up to 18 months. So often the lack of timely price confirmation leads investors to give up the macro framework altogether. And actually, it is definitely part of my job to keep the relevant macro trends on the radar and to ring the bell, basically, when they are in play. In this particular case, the crux of the matter is that it should be no surprise at all to see financial assets be derated as monetary conditions tighten. And this is actually part of a healthy natural selection process where the zombies are finally left to die and capital can be redistributed more predictively. So thinking about the Fed, in deciding whether it needs to react to a financial asset riot, it needs to determine whether the ongoing repricing is directly linked to sharply deteriorating growth prospect or whether it's simply down to the reactivation of financial assets after years of of super loose monetary policy. On this, I would like you to take a look at chart number 8. And you can see on the equity side that tighter monetary policy naturally comes in tandem with lower price earning ratio. However, the metric that really counts for me and that we should look at, and because it accounts for normalizing real interest rates, is the equity risk premium. And that really only discounts a softening of the growth profile. Clearly, more worrying is the sharp widening in credit spreads. And again, you can see that on chart 8. But how much of this deterioration in the quality of credit is just down to easy money-induced debtors' behaviors coming back to haunt them? It could simply be payback time after years of debt-financed equity buybacks. So if we had easier financial conditions, it would really only incentivize the return to non-productive investment, and that would be to the detriment of long-term economic prospects. Historically, you will see still on that chart that the Fed has only reacted to widening credit spreads when it was combined with growth falling below potential. And yesterday's ISM showed us that we're still very far from there. That's a capitulation that we observed in 2016 when ISM manufacturing fell below 50. And that would be basically recession territory and high yields credit spread exploded. But we are nowhere close to that sort of like red alert.
Okay, so from what you're saying, it sounds like you think the Fed would be ready to react to a sharp economic slowdown if one were to occur. But the question that begets is that something that's in the cards for 2019 based on your outlook?
I think there's no question that the U.S. economy is slowing, but this should not really be a surprise to anyone. After all, it is the Fed's goal to cool aggregate demand down and target growth sustainability. In fact, to me, the real surprise should be that the U.S. economy is still running way above potential and the manufacturing sector is so strong, especially versus the rest of the world, at the end of the second longest expansion on record after 8 hikes and with strong headwinds stemming from the weaker global outlook and also a much stronger dollar. So earlier this year, I highlighted that monetary conditions were no longer loose for the consumer. So you can see that on a chart 9, buying conditions are definitely tighter for cars and houses. And this is really something that was confirmed by the sharp drop in the home builders optimism index that you can see on chart 10.
I want to pick up on that theme because U.S. housing is a subject that awakens passionate feelings for a lot of our listeners. Can you give us any further insights on the U.S. housing market?
Definitely. I've had a deep look into the U.S. housing market, as it's obviously an important piece of the U.S. macroeconomic puzzle. And my conclusion is that it will undoubtedly contribute to the slowing of the U.S. economy, but it is in no way systemic. In fact, I would probably argue that medium-term fundamentals remain quite solid. And I will show you a few charts supporting this view. Firstly, you can see on chart 11 and 12 that housing supply has been in line with potential demand since the subprime crisis, and inventories are actually very low. The second thing is on chart 13, you will see that affordability has worsened, obviously, but it remains historically quite good. And my non-consensus view is that tighter monetary conditions may actually be necessary to restore price affordability. You know, I think it's quite easy to forget that super loose monetary conditions have largely contributed to housing bubbles, especially where supply was quite limited. And prime examples are London or Vancouver. Runaway house price pressures have caused affordability to worsen for new entrants. For example, if you see, take the chart 14, and you will see that the US median household has been slowly getting priced out of home ownership again through this cycle. And in my view, this really explains why the home ownership rate is only just recovering. The scar of the subprime crisis is still healing, and I can understand that it's tempting to infer from past experience that we are on the brink of recession. But let's not forget that regulations have tightened credit conditions. House equity withdrawal has been strictly limited over the past decade, and that results in a much lower correlation between this business cycle and the housing cycle. In addition, normalizing real rates automatically soften prices, which is more of a blessing for the haves not than a curse for the haves, because it restores price affordability and helps lessen intergeneration inequalities. I think this will eventually boost homeownership and support growth. So my conclusion really is that the ongoing slowdown in residential investment is not a harbinger of recession. More likely, housing demand is taking a breather due to higher prospective mortgage payments, but that's in expectation to leave price affordability to rebuild. And I think it would be a mistake for the Fed to make a U-turn just because of a softer housing market.
Okay, so I'm going to put you on the spot here. Where, in your best estimation, would you see a pause actually occurring in the Fed's hiking cycle?
My current estimate is that we see a minimum of 6 months before the Fed's domestic mandate converges with its global mandate on a weaker U.S. economy. So I think that should take U.S. interest rates to 2.75%, which again is like 3 more hikes. By that point, I think that lower inflation readings and disturbing activity trends should compel the Fed to pause. And it will even appear then that the long-term neutral rate is in fact lower and that monetary policy has turned overly restrictive.
Any other strong market views?
I know you always want to know about the dollar. And my conclusion there is that it is unlikely that the dollar will be the world's saving grace yet, as I don't really see new Shanghai Accord forthcoming. However, I think there is a window of opportunity for a weaker greenback unless the bond yield hawkish Fed combined with a weakening but not collapsing U.S. outlook. So I actually recommended to buy euro dollar at 113 with a stop at the year's low. I also think that EM equities will benefit from the softer U.S. and softer dollar outlook without collapse in activity. And I would now look to buy EM dips. I think that the Fed's data dependency means that there's a window of opportunity for the belly of the U.S. Treasury curve to catch up to a weakening outlook and softer asset prices. You can see this on chart 16. And I actually continue to recommend front-end flatteners. So that would be long 5 year versus short 1 year, which will eventually invert and potentially as another 50 basis points to go. I think that still is like my A trade to express the late cycle slowdown view. I will also look to rebuild short risk via outright shorts in credit or equities, because I think they need to reflect the normalization in interest rates. And really, the name of the game is payback time. And I think that's something we have to bear in mind. Lower equities, wider spreads does not necessarily reflect an immediate collapse in the outlook, but it also reflects the fact that we need to get out of super easy money.
Juliet, I really want to ask you, obviously you live in London, but you're very much French in descent. The situation that is unfolding in France right now with the so-called yellow vest movement has really perplexed me. I do understand that the economic circumstances, particularly for people that are less wealthy, has been very difficult. But good heavens, the amount of violence and anger that exists. What's driving this? What does it mean? And what are the market and economic effects and consequences that we should expect as fallout from everything that's going on?
I mean, that's a great question, because it's actually been one of my recurrent themes with far-reaching macroeconomic ramifications across the globe. And really, the point is about the social fracture, which is deepening between the haves and the ones who have basically benefited from globalization and financial repression, and the haves not. I think it would be a grave mistake to believe that the French upheaval is just a Franco-Francais event. The same malaise has expressed itself using the most readily available means. And I think in the US it was Trump, in UK it was Brexit. In Italy, it was the combo of Salvini and Di Maio. And most recently in Brazil, it was Bolsonaro. But I guess that French have a special thing about being blunt, saying things loud and like it is, rather than going through convoluted ways to express a view. And I know this full well, as it's got me in many trouble in England. The conventional wisdom was that France is Macron bucked the trend. The French president was initially hailed as the representative of a new order based on multilateralism, but it has now become apparent that Macron marked the beginning rather than the end of a brewing disquiet. And rather than embodying the new world, he represents the chaos between two worlds. And again, the two worlds is like, on one side, capital rich, who greatly enjoyed both globalization and central banks pumping up assets in the post-GFC era, and the workers who have been hit by globalization, have seen billionaires grow everywhere, and rampant asset inflation price them out of home ownership or even a decent retirement a little bit more every year. And they are nevertheless the ones being asked to pay for the ecological ravages of growth at all costs policies pursued over the past few decades. So I think the so-called yellow jackets movement, or gilets jaunes in French, is very peculiar in that it's not driven by a party or social cohort, but by the intense popular sentiment that the last few decades of economic growth flew way above the workers' head, which, by the way, it did. In France, the spark was a new diesel tax to accompany the ecological transitions. And what's the problem there? Well, it probably is the least progressive tax, firstly. But what is really interesting is the fact that for all violence and blockades, the movement is extremely popular. And that's something that is really unseen in France. So before the Paris destruction of this weekend, it was 84% backing of the spontaneous movement, which vows basically to achieve more equality through taxes and to rebalance spending power. So even after the Paris destruction of the weekend, it's still 75% backing. So in my opinion, the French are correctly identifying what their American, Italian, Brazilian, and English peers really have been feeling but could not voice accurately. I think the global malaise really finds its roots in globalization digging a rift between omnipotent multinationals and a powerless consumer. And I think this is not going away anytime soon. Just to go back to the 1789 revolution in France, it was a far-reaching social and political upheaval which altered the course of modern history by triggering the global decline of absolute monarchies while replacing them with republics and democracies. It is possible that this could be another 1789 moment.
Juliet, it's fascinating to hear your perspective on this, but concretely, how do we link this malaise that's going on, not just in France, but around the world, into the macro world and translate it to economic forecasts and outlooks?
So concretely, I think the upheaval is likely to really spill out into the European elections in 2019. But against like a very large consensus, I don't think it will be by causing the unraveling of the EU or the euro. I'd like to reiterate really that the French movement is not an anti-Brussels or anti-EU movement at all. I think more likely it will lead to more leniency towards increased spending and deficits as Italy becomes less isolated in its stubborn fiscal stance. I think today the French Prime Minister has already announced the temporary withdrawal of the diesel tax, and he will also have to loosen his grip on the fiscal purse to restore internal order. So that's I'm really looking towards like more leniency on the EU side, on the fiscal side. And that's really why I started to recommend long BTPs, so Italian 10-year BTPs, like about 2 weeks ago, and I still like to hold that. My other really important conclusion, well, at least it's very important for me, is that the whiff of French Revolution is also a big warning shot to central banks, because artificially inflating assets is a boon for the capital rich, but it is really a festering wand for those who have not had a chance to start accumulating retirement assets or even to get a first step on the property ladder. I really think that a return to financial repression risks stoking the populist fire, spreading discontent and frustration. And therefore, central banks really have to think much longer and much harder before deviating from the normalization path.
Well, Juliet, already I have been taking notes throughout this interview because at our event in Vancouver, I get to moderate a discussion forum where we're going to have you and our other five speakers on stage all at the same time. And I'm already thinking of ideas for topics. I'm really looking forward to seeing you debate and discuss with our other speakers. But why don't we come back to your own presentation at Macro Voices Live? What are you planning to talk to us about?
So as I mentioned earlier, I would really like to cover some of my favorite global leading indicators, but what really I will do is what I do for GDR research reports 2 to 3 times a month, and basically is covering subjects that are most relevant to the investment landscape in January and help your listeners extract returns. Most importantly, though, I'd like to mention that I'm really looking forward to meet very smart investors and exchange views as well as learn more about their interest and real investment objectives.
Well, you'll have plenty of opportunity to do that. That was actually the biggest feedback we got out of Toronto, was people wanted more FaceTime with speakers. So we've got two receptions, one before the event and one after the event, and plenty of opportunity to meet the attendees. So we're really looking forward to seeing you there in Vancouver. Before I let you go, though, please give us a quick summary of what you do at JDI Research, what products you offer, and what you have available to our Macro Voices listeners.
Really, what I try and provide is research and strategy dedicated to traders. My main concern is they're benefiting from my views, my macroeconomic views. What I provide is two different services. One of them is via JDI Research Reports, which I publish about like 2 to 3 times per month, and also update via email constantly on the basis of any game changes or any new ideas and et cetera. But I also have a service which is dedicated to CIOs and portfolio managers, where I'll be every day on Bloomberg, you know, giving you the whole thought process between one report to the other on any kind of like event data, big market moves, and et cetera. I'll be happy again this year to give an interesting discount for either service to Macro Voices listeners, and that will be available until Christmas, and also means that those interested would receive access to all historical reports.
Fantastic. So for people who want to take you up on that, how do they contact you to find out more about what you're offering?
My email is juliette.declercq@jdiresearch.com, and you can find that through our website, jdiresearch.com, and just press the contact button, and I will personally reply to anyone with getting in touch.
Well, Juliette, we cannot thank you enough for another fantastic interview, and I particularly look forward to seeing you next month in Vancouver and getting you on the stage at the same time with our other guests. We're going to have to leave it there in the interest of time, but Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Juliette back on the show. Right off the bat, she gets right into the tight U.S. dollar liquidity conditions in the market. And what really I found very powerful when she was saying was that the Fed is the world's de facto central bank. And when the Fed right now is working off its jobs and inflation mandate, we see, though, that they're not, at least in my mind, taking into consideration the impact that they're having on the rest of the world by not providing that liquidity. What did you take away from the interview?
It's funny, you know, I started on exactly the same point you did, but in a different facet of it, which is when Juliette started talking about the dollar liquidity shortage, I thought, wow, okay, Juliette has come around exactly to the Jeff Snyder view. And I expected her to say, and for this reason, I have changed my, you know, short view on the U.S. dollar outlook and become a dollar bull. And she said, no, I've got this view of a dollar shortage, but I don't think it leads to the price of the dollar necessarily moving higher relative to other currencies. And she still got, maybe not right this instant, but longer term, a bearish dollar outlook, and doesn't think that that is at all inconsistent with this liquidity crisis in the dollar. So I can't wait to get Juliette and Jeff Snyder on stage at the same time together in Vancouver when we do our town hall session with all of the speakers on stage at the same time, because I want to get Julian and Jeff Snyder on this question of how do you both have exactly the same idea but come to almost opposite conclusions from it. So that was the main thing I took away, Patrick. But I want to get right back to our big picture trading chart book. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your research roundup email. It says big picture trading chart book. Let's go straight to page 2, which is where I got that quote that I read in the market wrap, where you said, we're going into this week actively looking to short sell any strength after the G20 meetings. Well, you got that one right, buddy. We went right up there above 2,800, and a lot of people were saying, that's it. G20 has basically set the stage. The rest of the year is guaranteed to be a rally. And I saw so many people on Twitter saying, you know, we're going from here up to 2,850 to 2,900 by year end. And I'll continue with what you say on the quote here. I am suspicious that the strength will be faded. Yeah, I would say so. Any SPY shorts will need to be done in hedge position trades. So tell us more. You've obviously nailed that call, and anybody who shorted 2800 or 2805 or whatever that high was right after the G20 has done extremely well. Have we seen a bottom today? Because we did touch a bottom and bounce off of a number just slightly below that Thanksgiving low. Is this over? Or are we headed back up to another test of 2800? Or what do you think comes next?
Well, until we've broken to a new low, we certainly can't rule out the possibility that we stay range bound. So even though the sell-off was incredibly violent, it really has been simply contained to the trade range that the S&P has been in since the middle of October. You know, 2800 was sort of the upper boundary and 2600 being the lower boundary. And we've been bouncing 200 S&P points back and forth within this range. Now, there is a lot of support down here below the market, particularly even if we poked down to a lower low below this kind of 2620, 2630 area where all these short-term lows are coming, because there's going to be that range from which the February and April lows from earlier this year all came in. And so there's a lot of risks of where there could be short-term liquidity shifts where buyers buy the dip and quickly and violently throw back the market. But really, in my mind, unless we see the market decisively get above 2740 on the upside, I'm going to be shorting rallies at this stage. I'm going to be actually continuing to play the downside. I called that 2740 level on this S&P my bull bear pivot. And so if we have any little bounce here, I'll probably short. I also drew on there two measured moves using the techniques that we teach in our Tech Masters program. We measured out the 2480. We can round it more or less to 2500 as a measured target on the downside, and then 2390, which I guess we can also round to about 2400 level for an extended move. Now, I'm not necessarily banking on the fact that the market's going to rip down to like 2400 or something. Just those are reference levels on the market. But really, the big test in my mind is that will on any bounce here, we get a market that a seller's just hit it again, and especially if it happens below 2740, I think it's going to still be the window's still open for a brand new short.
Let's move on to the gold chart on page 3 here, because I've certainly been watching this. It seems like, you know, certainly the gold just does nothing but go opposite the dollar index that we saw for months and months. That's over. We're into a new regime. I haven't quite figured out exactly what the new regime is. What are your thoughts here?
Well, I just really wanted to put a chart up for us to look at what's been happening with gold. The first initial break on gold above 1230, which was a level that we've been watching with our members, came up at the same time as the Chinese renminbi broke out to the upside as well. And so you had this kind of first impulse that from that correlation that existed against the yuan. But right now, gold is at a very interesting level. I mean, I know that some CTA models are putting that level a little bit higher than the 1245, which we were watching earlier in the month. But I still think this is a pretty important level. If gold, especially in this market environment, can spurt up higher, it should drive a lot of the technical alarm bells for a lot of traders that gold is game on, and maybe we'll see a liquidity shift where people are chasing this thing, and maybe we'll see them gunning for that 1300 on the upside. I think it's a must watch. We have not broken out yet in my mind. And so this is one of the key things I want to watch this week.
Well, I agree completely with that. I do want to mention again, as I said earlier, Charlie McElligott's pivot number that we talked so much about on this program around 1245, that is based on a dynamic model that changes with the markets. That inflection point number where a whole bunch of CTAs would shift their positioning and go more long of gold has moved up to 1284, and that's the number where CTAs, according to Nomura's model, would go to about 89% long exposure. So the 1245 is not really a magic number anymore, but I agree with you. We haven't quite seen a breakout above this recent range, but we're awfully close to it. So we'll see what happens. Let's move on now, though, to the yield curve, because we've got a lot of people paying huge attention, and I think there's been some confusion in the market. The inversion of the U.S. Treasury yield curve has happened at the front of the curve. So the 2s 5s, the difference between the 2-year and 5-year treasury, has gone to a negative differential, meaning an inverted yield curve. The 2s 10s, which is the one that a lot of people really watch as the primary measure of the yield curve, hasn't quite gone negative yet, but we're getting awful close to it. So on the 2s 5s, we're looking at a negative spot 0.013, and we're looking at only 11 basis points of positive yield curve on the 2s 10s. Give us the story here. Certainly, we're moving in a direction which normally would be a recession signal. I guess the counter to that is people are saying there's so much going on with Trump, Xi, et cetera, that maybe it's distorting signals a little bit. What do you think here?
Well, my first intuition, the real reason I put this up, first of all, A, it was an inversion. I mean, we haven't seen an inversion since 2007 in the U.S. curve. So it is a speaking point, and just the fact that it's happened, even though it's at the shorter end of the curve, a lot of people put a lot more relevance on the 2s and 10s, and, you know, that hasn't inverted yet. But what I really wanted to speak to was this idea that because the last time we saw an inversion, the recession didn't happen for like 18 months. We started inverting, I think, was it in 2006? And the recession didn't happen till 2008. And so a lot of people there are saying, well, there's the 18-month countdown clock. But one of my big narratives at Big Picture Trading is I think it plays out a little bit different this time, because this time I feel it's the rest of the world that is starting to really see the cracks. You know, using a top to bottom measurement of the stock markets in Germany, which is now in a bear market down 20%, Italy and China, we see that there's bear markets in all three markets, at least by the measure of 20% or more down on their stock markets. We see the global economy slowing. I feel that there's a real chance that there's a global economic recession much sooner. And what I almost envision is it's almost like the U.S. economy is struggling along and would on its own have no problem lasting another 18 months. But what if the global markets grab the U.S. markets by the heels and just drag them down? And we just have a global economic slowdown act like a contagion, and somehow it spills into the U.S., accelerating this whole thing. What do you think of that idea?
Patrick, I agree with your conclusion very much. I actually come to it from a slightly different line of thinking, which is I look at this as we have got a market situation which has been pumped up by a lot of easy money policy from central banks around the world to a level that most people thought was impossible. And all of us skeptics have been proven wrong or proven early, as the case may be. I think that we're at such a level that when things finally start to break, and I'm not sure if we're quite there yet, but when we get to that point where things start to break, I think they break harder and faster than anyone expects. And one of the reasons that I say that is the last time that we had a major market dislocation was 2008. And although you did have Reg NMS had been passed in 2007, really you didn't have anything remotely close to the algorithmic trading, particularly high frequency trading, which has come to take over a huge, huge percentage of market volumes. So I think the computers are rigged to move this sucker in the fall apart direction really, really fast when we get to the point where it is clear that the system is breaking. Now, I'm not sure that we're there yet, and I've been early a whole bunch of times and proven wrong saying, oh, I think we're almost there. So I don't know if this is it, but when things break, I think they break harder and faster than anyone else is predicting. And that plays very much into your conclusion, although I get there from a completely different line of logical deduction. But Patrick, for anyone who just can't wait for yield curve inversion, you Canadians are leading once again. Take a look at page 6. What's going on with the Canadian 2s-5s? Why do you think it is so much more inverted? It wasn't any more inverted than the U.S. 2s-5s a couple weeks ago, but boy, it sure is now. What's going on there?
Well, I don't know if I'm overreading into the magnitude of the drop, but what is interesting is that the Canadian yield curve, at least on the 2s and 5s, inverted literally the same time as the U.S. one did. It happened the other day, and both of them inverted. Now, what was interesting was that the Bank of Canada came out with its rate announcement, keeping interest rates unchanged up here in Canada. But really, their outlook on the economy worsened, and the Canadian dollar broke rather badly on the news, but so did the yield curve. And so what's interesting is that it came the same time as the U.S. one, and there was no rate hike, though. But it's interesting that things have also inverted up in Canada at the same time.
Moving on to slide 7, we're looking at the euro-dollar spread. And again, to explain what the euro-dollar spread is about, it's the difference in price between the December of 2018 and December of 2019 futures. Why is that difference in price important? Because it's a good proxy for what the market is discounting in terms of how many rate hikes might be in store for us from the Federal Reserve during that same period. It does not appear that this chart is looking bullish to me. Patrick, what's going on?
This was a chart me and you talked about last week, and we were at 23 basis points. 1 week later, we at one point were at 11 basis points. I think earlier today, the probability of a March rate hike dropped down to under 50%. And so it's really interesting in my mind that the market is just calling the Fed's bluff that they're going to keep raising rates. You know, the easiest market condition is when the markets price in the rate hike and then the Fed does it. But really what we have here in my mind is a market that is basically starting to suggest that there might be even a better than a 50% probability that December might be the last rate hike. And it's going to be really interesting to see if that plays out.
And I just want to point out, too, to give credit where it's due, if we think back to when Keith McCullough appeared on the program, that was around the second week of November. At that point, we had seen what looked like a bottom. The market was bouncing aggressively. It seemed like the market was expecting more hikes, not less. Keith McCullough comes on the program and sounds like a total lunatic to say he thinks the December rate hike is going to be the last one, when it seems like a really strong bounce is in play in this euro dollar spread. Holy cow, look at what the market is telling us. And it is so consistent with, as much as Keith sounded crazy to say one more, you just looked at the chart and said, that's not what the market's discounting. Well, it's discounting it now. So kudos to our friends at HedgeEye for nailing the call on that one. Meanwhile, before we wrap the show up, Patrick, I want to touch on slide 8 here, because you are still offering a free 7-day trial to your entire service at bigpicturetrading.com. Listeners, you can find information at bigpicturetrading.com or email contact@bigpicturetrading.com. On that note, we're going to call it a show for this week. We need your help promoting Macro Voices, so please tell your friends and colleagues all about us. Forward your research roundup emails. Most importantly, register your free account at macrovoices.com. While you're there, don't be afraid to donate this holiday season. We sure do appreciate your donations that help us defray our production costs. And of course, the benefit to you is that you'll receive our free research roundup email, which never contains advertising or marketing. It's just a compendium of links to all of the best free content we can find on the internet each week. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's research roundup.
In the research roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book for both Juliet's presentation and the charts we discussed in the post game. There's an article from Ray Dalio that this debt cycle will end soon. And there's also an interesting article talking about Saxo Bank's 10 outrageous predictions for 2019. I thought it was actually a really fun read. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Sresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Sresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.